This podcast is supported by Talkspace.
When my husband came home from his military deployment, readjusting was hard for all of us. Thankfully, I found Talkspace.
Talkspace provides professional support from licensed therapists and psychiatric providers online. Military members, veterans, and their dependents ages 13 and older can get fast access to providers, all from the privacy of their computers or smartphones.
I just answered a few questions online, and Talkspace matched me with a therapist. We meet when it's convenient for me, and I can message her anytime. It was so easy to set up, and they accept TRICARE. Therapy was going so well, my husband and I started seeing a couples therapist through Talkspace, too.
Talkspace works with most major insurers, including TRICARE. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com/military. Go to Talkspace.com/military to get started today. That's Talkspace.com/military.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
I'm sorry about your daughter, Joel.
But I have lost people, too.
You have no idea what loss is.
You have no idea what loss is.
Everyone I have cared for has either died or left me.
Everybody, fucking except for you.
Don't tell me that I would be safer with someone else, because the truth is, I would just be more scared.
Beware, spoiler-phobes! You have stumbled into A Storm of Spoilers, a podcast currently covering The Last of Us Season 2 and split into two sections. The first section of the podcast we call The Calm, where we can only talk about things that happened on the series up to Season 2, Episode 3, The Path. The second section of the podcast we call The Storm, as in A Storm of Spoilers, where we talk about adaptation changes from The Last of Us Part 2, The Game, and speculate on what we might see in the remaining episodes of this season and beyond. We're not ruining, we're enriching, and we're not infected yet. Why, hello, I'm Dave Gonzalez.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I am delighted once again to welcome you back to A Storm of Spoilers. And as always, I get to do a little housekeeping before we get started here. Our upcoming schedule, of course, we're still on The Last of Us. We've got at least half a season to go here in season two. Episodes, of course, dropping every Wednesday. Hopefully that's when you're listening to this. Although, again, it's a podcast. Listen to it whenever you want during the week, whatever's convenient for you. We'll have episode 4, of course, for you next week. We're very excited to continue on this particular journey. Also, if you are interested in getting stormy details of what happens in the video game, I've been having a really great time Monday nights starting at 8 o'clock Central on Twitch, twitch.tv/Neilstradamus. That's NeilStradomus, playing The Last of Us Part 2 Remastered. Had a really great, again, I use fun as a relative term for this because it's getting very dark in part two. Part two is a wild game. One of my favorite video game experiences of all time. This was the third week, I guess. I've been playing along with the show. I'm way ahead plot wise at this point, but we made it to a very, very interesting part that I'm sure we'll discuss in the storm. So be sure to join me on Twitch Monday evenings, again, 8 o'clock Central. And if you would like more from Dave and I, we podcast multiple times a week. You can join us patreon.com/DaveandNeil, DaveandNeil, for more content from the past of this feed, the bonus content from our Lost podcast, our Game of Thrones podcast that we did with Joanna Robinson, and ongoing new content, our Pop Culture Adventure that publishes every Friday, our Leftovers project that we've been working on for folks at the $10 level of the Patreon, that we are about almost halfway through season 3 of The Leftovers. It's been a lot of fun. We're actually going to talk about that in the storm of this week's Last of Us pod. And you can also get our Twin Peaks project that we did. There's just like a ton of stuff in there. And on top of that, you get access to a really great Slack community that is one of the least toxic, most enjoyable places that you can interact socially with cool people on the internet, mostly because social media sucks these days. so there you have it. More places that you can get more interaction with us. We hope you will continue to join us. But let's get back to the topic at hand. This podcast, Storm of Spoilers. How do you get in touch with this show? You can always send us a raven, which many of you did in the last week after I pouted about it last week. So thank you very much.
It always works.
It always works. You can send us a raven, of course, to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. We're going to read a few of them here in a moment. Greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your week to send your thoughts and questions and comments to us. I know you have so many options when it comes to interacting with podcasts that are covering this show, but yeah, we appreciate you talking to us. You can also, of course, review us on iTunes. You can leave us comments on Spotify. Our rule, as always, going back through the 370 plus episodes that exist in this feed, is if you leave us a 5-star rating, you say whatever you want, whether it's nice or not. Mostly people are saying nice things, including this review from Fezziwig, which is a great name, who said this week, "I'm so glad Dave and Neil are back for The Last of Us. I recently did a rewatch of Game of Thrones and listened to all the Storm of Spoilers episodes. I also love Trial by Content, was bummed when it disappeared. I miss Joanna, of course, but 2 out of 3 is better than 0. That is technically, mathematically true. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yeah. She's also covering The Last of Us.
Also so covering The Last of Us.
It's not a full 0, just we're shouting across a gorge at each other.
Yes, exactly. And if you are looking for the 3.5-hour version of a deep dive every week, listen to Joanna and Mel over on the Ringerverse.
If you like your gender switched with the other gender,
that's true.
Another gender.
Yes.
Over there.
Absolutely.
You got two fantastic women talking about it.
We highly recommend. So yes, thank you for leaving us those ratings. That helps this podcast get out to more people and obviously helps us grow. And that's good stuff. So we will continue to read those every week. Moving on to some of your emails, some of your ravens. This first one comes from Magnus, who is making a suggestion that we bring forward some of the things that we have previously done on this podcast, specifically on the Lost podcast. Magnus says, how about some corners for The Last of Us? Examples could include The Last of Lust or Smuggle That Kiss. Most creative fungal growth. That's an interesting one. Best final words. Most creative fungal growth. And most obvious lie could carry over well. And I like this, Dave. We'll have to work on it a little bit. We'll workshop a couple of
I like most corners, obvious I guess. Lie. I think we could like lean into that for this show. Absolutely. The other ones, it's like sometimes I want people to kiss. But other times it would feel weird to have like certain episodes maybe where we actually maybe not. Maybe we it's could true. Always go for who should be kissing in the apocalypse. Maybe that's something we need to bring to all of our post-apocalyptic examinations.
Yeah, I thought about that one and it's like, I think our options might be getting a little limited though. Because it's like, can Ellie and Dina really win that every week? Right.
Well, but this is a show that gave us a cordyceps kiss of Anna Torv in season one. So it could be a kiss that spreads further disease. Their mouths touching for the rest of the season.
That is true. That is true. All right. So we're going to take that under advisement and look for corner opportunities. And I think lie related ones that could come up very quickly here. Our second Raven, we actually got a couple of these that I'm going to read. We got some Eugene theories because I was very interested in this. The first one comes from Tom, who says, I think that he committed an act that was egregious. It couldn't be forgiven. It was so bad that even banishment would be letting him off easy. He did something that put the whole community at risk. He was growing cordyceps. Maybe it was his own way of trying to find a cure, but it was something considered far too risky to allow to continue. It could also explain why no one has tried to take over his growing operation since he passed away. Very interesting one here, Tom. Growing cordyceps would be a huge no-no in this particular world and hugely dangerous, right?
Yeah.
Although I don't... I guess I'm not sure how he would be safe doing that. I feel like if you were trying to grow cordyceps, you would very quickly get infected.
I mean, but it seems like it, and it seems like he's more interested in, you know, the cultivating of pot and hanging out with his wife. The thing about the so egregious it couldn't be forgiven, that makes me wonder a little bit more about Catherine O'Hara's reaction when she was speaking to Joel, where like she knew that he needed to be put down, but she's still mad at him. Becomes a little bit more complicated if he does something where it's like, oh, that was really bad. Growing cordyceps, you know, maybe I'm Resident Evil pilled, but that does sound like something that some idiot would try to do. Just like, maybe if I could grow a batch that's separate from the hive batch, it could be like a friendly cordyceps. Like, I don't agree with it. I agree with your previous statement that it would get you pretty quickly. But as a fan of the zombie genre, occasionally there are dummies who try to control that breakout.
And listen, to Tom's credit with this theory, that is, to a great extent, stoner logic. Like, if he was out there and he was very confident in his ability to create like hybrid strains of weed, why then wouldn't he be like, I could create a hybrid strain of cordyceps that is like super, is super different than the original cordyceps, that maybe you could inject it into a human and it would make them immune or something like that. So maybe. And again, Eugene, despite being dead, has been cast as Joey Pants. So like, we feel like we are going to see him at some point in a flashback. We're going to get this answer. I got another one for you. This actually comes, I'm going to read the one from Suzanne, but we also, Heather wrote in with a very similar theory. So this is on a lot of folks' mind. Suzanne says, from the way Ellie reacted to Jesse's comment in the 7-Eleven, I thought that potentially Eugene, Joel, and Ellie were on patrol and he discovered Ellie's immunity, whether because they got bit or something else, and then Joel caused him to get bit and therefore needed to be shot. And I kind of like this one. So it's like, whether Eugene actually got bit or not, like the official story when they got back to town was Eugene got bit and we had to kill him. But the real reason was he discovered Ellie's secret. And I think that also seems likely. He discovers
Ellie's secret. Ellie bites him and then Joel shoots him. Everybody's complicit.
Sure. Yeah.
I mean, I do see something like this happening only because I really the show is the show that walks the gray line of people who do things that are good and people who do things that are bad for reasons that they believe are good. So I do think this is going to be complicated. Certainly Ellie's immunity is due for a complication since we've spent, you know, so much time, rightfully so, but mourning Joel. I think that's going to have to come back up eventually, much like the secret, I think, has to come back up eventually.
Yeah. And I think this might have actually come up in Heather's email, which, again, was very similar along these lines. But the idea that Eugene was formerly a Firefly, something that gets brought up in this week's episode, you know, Dina talking about how it was Eugene that sort of told her about these groups out west that the Fireflies were aware of. So potentially Eugene finding out about what happened in Salt Lake City and maybe putting two and two together and figuring out that like that was Joel that did it and that Ellie was the girl that would have been the one to cure everybody. And then that's why Joel had to put him down. Whatever the reason then that they gave the town is, again, maybe they're like, he got bit while we were on patrol, but to keep Ellie's secret seems like the kind of reason Joel would have to take out someone like Eugene. So I kind of like that. Lots of great Eugene theories out there. And I'm excited for the show to maybe give us the answer. We'll see. We got plenty of episodes.
Who knows? Who knows what we're doing from week to week?
All right. I got one more Raven. It is from our friend Phelan. I've summarized it a little bit. I cut it down a little bit. And I think this is a good starting point for this week's episode because it gets us into the Ellie and Abby of it all. Phelan says, what if I said I think Joel allowed Abby to kill him, that he believed her pursuit to be ultimately righteous, and that his compliance was his cosmic debt for saving Ellie. And maybe the recent murder of a former Firefly necessary to keep his past sins covered. I think he's referencing Eugene there. And by seeking revenge, is Ellie upsetting the scales of justice again? Or, and I'm adding this, should she, as the guy in the town meeting suggests, take the path of mercy? So it's the idea that, like, Joel's sort of the way he reacts in the scene with Abby is he's not trying to get out of it, right? He seems pretty resigned to the whole situation. He's like, get it over with. Yeah. Is he sort of realizing that this is him paying the cost? And then Ellie's decision in this episode to go to Seattle and try to kill Abby, is this her sort of upsetting those scales of justice once again and starting, I guess, the cycle of violence all over again? Should she take the guy from Star Trek Discovery? He played the doctor on Star Trek Discovery. Right? Should she take the high road? What do you think?
I mean, that it's at the core, I think, of what we're supposed to be asking ourselves this episode. And I think it's at, you know, the center of what the show was going to ultimately be asking us is, are we on the side of this revenge kick because it happened to Joel? I think the episode is pretty masterfully put together as a Joel mourning episode to the degree that we're supposed to be really feeling that we're on Ellie and Dina's side when they set off. Like, of course, this is the right thing to do. But I do think that, you know, Phelan's onto something here, that right now there is a certain type of balance and a certain type of justice. So Ellie in the town meeting is arguing to Maria, who used to be a prosecutor, like, I just want justice like you used to bring to people. And that is from, like, and I think a lot of versions of justice in an apocalypse fiction are based around the idea of justice from one singular perspective. We as the audience get to be the people judging with a like greater perspective than any of the characters have, which I think means we're supposed to be wrestling with this question all the time. I, of course, want Ellie and Dina to spend time flirting in a tent on a road trip on Shimmer. Like, all of that's great. The reality is they're going there to commit a whole bunch of more murders that, you know, at some point were going to be part of a posse and, like, maybe more akin to a episode of Gunsmoke. But when the town votes them down, now this is a two-person revenge kick, and it's the two people who were there when Joel was killed. But it was also two people who were there when Joel was killed, and they weren't around for Abby's entire monologue, so they don't know why it might have been justified. So I think Phelan's onto something in the sense that this is exactly what the show wants us on that precipice of. Whether or not they come down on either side of it, I think I'm really having to take episode to episode, because again, this episode, it ends and I'm on Ellie's side, but it is very emotionally manipulative to keep me on Ellie's side. Even when we're being introduced to a new faction, the people who were whistling and carrying hammers were introduced through a father-daughter sort of perspective. So when horrible things happen to them, we're like, oh, this is horrible. The wolves are horrible. We, like Ellie, are like, this is even more reason to go after Abby. But I suspect that's not the whole story, because we didn't see what actually happened to them. And I don't know anything about them, but I do have some baked in opinions about religious fanatics. So who knows, really?
Right. We don't know why they all have scars on their face. Specifically, why do the children have scars on their face? That's pretty messed up, right?
Yeah.
Like, immediately it's like, okay, I can tell that these are like religious fanatics. And I would understand why, like, the adults would have some sort of like commitment to the level of like facially mutilating themselves. But when they show the little girl with the scars on her face, it's like, well, these people are a little intense, man. Like, I feel bad that they got obviously massacred in the woods there. That's terrible. But also, you know, I have questions.
I mean, I definitely have questions. I'll take your lead on it, and in that if you feel bad for the kids, I'll feel bad for the kids. For me, I don't know enough yet. Like, you know, circumcision also seems super violent, but we do that to kids. So it's like, maybe there's a reason for it, a cultural reason that'll make sense. Maybe there's like a anti-cordyceps test where you got to slip both your cheeks. I don't know. Really, I was trying to figure out, this is good. I'm glad you brought it up because I was thinking about putting it in our notes and sort of like emphasizing the scars. But then I was like, how do I do it? I think I have a trauma memory of being in like a group of kids in middle school and making fun of the singer Seal for having a scarred face and then learning that it's sort of like tribal scars and I was being a little ignorant asshole. So I'm always very careful. And I was like, how can I talk about this? I'm like, they're Joker-esque scars. And I'm like, now I'm just making light of it. Like, what the fuck? So I'm very interested to learn more about these people and their ritualistic scars.
Yeah. I mean, because it definitely like they all have sort of the same exact scars on both sides of their face. So it's clearly part of their deal, right?
Yeah.
It's just as much as part of their, I guess you would say, culture at this point as the whistling, as their dress code, as their commitment to talking about their prophet and what her whole deal was. So it will be interesting to see how quickly we learn more about them. And again, it's very fascinating to have it not just be the adults, but also the children.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So,
like that's a fully committed group all the way around.
It's also them. And when he gives his child the hammer, we'll skip around the whole episode. I assume if you're listening to this podcast, you've watched the episode. That's like, there's violence as like a motion of justice, which I think is what the town meeting was about, like sending out a semi-official posse from a, you know, organized group of people, as opposed to like the WLF, which might have sent their own posse for as much as we know, but is definitely like more of a militia, but still a large group of people like grouping together. They could have more official actions where it's like this revenge tour is more about what I've been talking about with the other episodes, which is like, can violence be a demonstration of love? And this scarred man giving his child, a child that he's responsible for, a hammer to sort of make her feel safe. I'm like, there it is again. So it's like, what level of violence are you willing to perpetrate for a person you love? Is getting kind of tangled up in the idea of justice here, I think, in a really masterful way. I enjoyed how this episode sort of made time in between our seemingly rising action, in that if you would have told me, you know, Joel was murdered and then everybody set out the next day immediately to get revenge, I would have been like, of course they did. But the show managed to navigate around a couple of ways. First, Ellie looks like had a punctured lung and therefore needs to recover for a significant period of time. At second, Tommy needs to rebuild the town with he and Jesse taking turns putting in more base for more wall, it looks like, or maybe a new tower. But then we have a 3-month time jump, which is my understanding, Neil, does not happen in the game.
Yeah, that's true. It's more immediate in the game that the action picks up. And I think I was, you know, watching both behind the scenes and listening to the official podcast. Neil Druckmann, the creator of the game and producer on the show, talked about this being sort of an important thing that they were able to do with the show that they weren't really able to do with the game, because the game being very action based kind of needs you as the player to get going, right? Needs to get you in Ellie's shoes, get you moving on with the story. Whereas the show can kind of take this time to not only grieve for Joel, but, you know, take this time to set up what has happened and kind of debrief what has happened in Jackson. I think as a result of this new thing that they did in the last episode, which is this huge infected siege of Jackson, which I thought was very cool. You know, it's good that they dealt with that, right? It'd be kind of weird if like Ellie wakes up, you know, a couple days later and they just like fuck off to Seattle and we never like think about what happened in Jackson. And it also gives the show time to have this conversation about like Joel not being the only person they lost, right? This community. And like, yes, Joel seemed like he was pretty important to everyone in this community. But, you know, even in that first scene where we see Tommy go in and have that very touching moment with his brother's body, you know, there's that pan at the end where it pans away and we just see the other people that died, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's like Joel was killed in this very specific way, right? That is different from how the other people died. The other people were killed by the infected, which is, you know.
Well, presumably Seth said he was injured with friendly fire, sure. Which was one of my questions about last week, because it did get pretty chaotic there for a little bit.
Yeah, but you know, it seems like everybody else died as part of the chaos of the infected coming to Jackson, whereas Joel was killed very specifically by this group of outsiders that came in and were looking specifically for him. So I think there's a little bit that's different about that, but I really liked it. I think, you know, we were kind of talking about expecting there to be some kind of like flashback episode, diversionary episode, something to parallel the Bill and Frank episode from last season, which was again one of the bigger adaptation choices of season one, which was to spend time with Bill and Frank. And I don't know if this is it, right? We obviously have more episodes to go, but this felt very adjacent to that, where it's like, even though it's not a flashback episode, it's a bridge episode that is sort of taking its time to go in a different direction and really doesn't have any infected related action. I think that's sort of the key, is it's all about like moving our characters in a particular direction and, you know, obviously getting our characters from point A to point B and focusing on the relationships and the dynamics between the characters. And again, we don't really see, other than the burned ones at the beginning, we don't really interact with any infected. And we don't really have any big action in this. You know, most of it happens, I think all of it pretty much happens off screen, right? We don't see what happens to the religious folks. We cut away from it. So
yeah,
I feel like this is kind of that same thing where it's like the show taking a little breather to be like, let's obviously have some downtime to mourn for Joel, which is, again, something the game couldn't do, chose not to do, you know, eventually finds a way to do in its own time, you know, but I think it's a good, important TV thing to do here. And especially because we get, you know, we get the really important stuff. One thing that this episode does that the game did really well is the scene where Ellie returns to Joel's house. And I think that is hugely important and would have been terrible for them to leave it out. And it's so important that, like, when I was watching the behind the scenes, director Peter Hoare is talking about how they built the interior of Joel's house specifically just for this one scene, which seems kind of excessive, right? For this,
yes,
just a couple minutes in this one episode. But it's that important, right? Her walking through this space, her sort of occupying and not just like when she gets to the bedroom and opens the box, which is a huge moment in the game, and she sees the watch, and obviously that's a huge totem of his relationship with Sarah, and she leaves the watch and takes the gun instead, which I always read as a real indication of like the difference in the relationships and what is sort of important in the relationships, the important difference in Joel's relationship with his two daughter figures, right? His actual daughter, it was about the watch and him holding onto that watch as a memory of Sarah. And then the gun is more indicative of his relationship with Ellie, which has been about protection, and it's about the violence of that he has taught her,
which is sort of what Gail is telling Tommy.
Yeah, exactly.
In the baseball outfield.
Yeah, so it's like that's how she is a lot more like him, I guess, in that Ellie is more of the violent side of Joel than she is the sentimental side of Joel, I guess, that Sarah was. So it's hugely important. Then I think obviously the moment she has with his jacket is huge. And you know, it's a great piece of acting from Bella Ramsey. I think she's really good in this. And it's a huge moment to show, because it's, you know, we've been watching The Leftovers and we've been talking about tracking characters who are not okay, right? And characters who are projecting to other characters that they are okay but are very much not okay. And Ellie is a textbook example of a character who is projecting to everyone around her that she's fine, that she's moved on. She has this whole sequence with Gail where she's giving her the version that she thinks is going to get Gail off of her back, right?
Well, and the version that we know, but seems like there's something more to it.
Sure.
Like, because we know about the Fireflies at the end of last season, but also it seems like there's something else Ellie isn't telling us about her interactions with Joel. Which brings me to a question I have for you, Neil.
Sure.
This is just a way to praise the fantastic actors in this show, because I do think in that conversation with Gail, we're seeing two of the contenders for what might be this award. But who on this show is the best at acting something that the audience needs to read as a lie, but the characters need to at least let pass as the truth? This show is filled with a lot of people who lie for character development, and it's a very difficult acting skill to not be overselling it to the point that, you know, obviously other characters would figure it out. And I think like an argument for Bella Ramsey here is in the town meeting, I get so wrapped up in the scene that when she's talking about like do it for us, I almost believe her,
right?
Until later on Gail just reinforces that she lies the whole time. And so then you got to go back, and the second time I watched that performance, I'm like, can I tell the lie? And I'm like, I can't necessarily tell the lie, but I can see her start putting on a performance, which is another type of acting. So who on the show is the best at acting a lie?
I mean, I actually think that Catherine O'Hara is better at acting the lie and slipping it by us. But I agree with you in the sense that Bella Ramsey is giving a good performance of almost getting it by us. Right.
Yeah.
But reading it in a way where there's a couple layers, right? We can kind of feel that Ellie is putting on a performance and that she's not giving us the entire truth, and that is probably a slightly higher bar as far as like the actual acting performance, right? Is like to show that this character is trying to lie and is almost getting it, but is maybe not all the way there because she's letting some of the emotional truth of how she's feeling about Joel slip through. Right. And I think that, she's not going to be able to keep that lie up completely with everyone. Right. Like she, you know, she's in the scene in the house, she's able to like wipe away the tears and she goes out and has a conversation with Dina, but it's like, how long is she going to be able to keep that all to herself, right? And not especially the longer she spends with Dina, how long is she going to be able to not have Dina figure her out?
I mean, we're going to see. They're definitely trying to figure each other out a little bit.
You know, and I think based on that conversation that Gail and Tommy have, I think Gail may have already figured her out, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's very possible. So, what do you think about what Gail says about, like, some people you just can't save? Isn't that counterintuitive to most Western fiction narratives that you've encountered in your life?
Maybe. I mean, do you think that she's... I kind of question, like, what is Gail's purpose there? Like, what does she think Tommy is thinking? And what does she think that she is she trying to prevent Tommy from doing thing, like doing something, right? Is she trying to say to Tommy, like, let Ellie go, let Ellie do what she's going to do, you know, don't get involved in whatever Ellie's about to go do, because, you know, Gail obviously lives a fairly comfortable life, even though she's a very stressed out therapist. And I would imagine being a person who is a caretaker of sorts for many of the people in town, she sees Tommy's value as being a leader in the community, as being obviously very important to Maria. And she can, I would imagine, feel Tommy gravitating toward maybe wanting to help Ellie. If Ellie's going to go do something stupid, right? And she can sense it. Would she be saying that to be like, Tommy, just let her go do something stupid. Don't get involved. We need you here to rebuild. And that to me is part of what I would add to the case for Catherine O'Hara being really good at selling the lie. Right. Because I don't know if she necessarily believes that some people are beyond saving. But I think that's the message she needs Tommy to have in that moment, which is like, you may not be able to prevent Ellie from going and trying to kill Abby. So, you know, let her do what she's going to do and don't get too involved, because, like, we all really need you here. You know, so that we don't get run over by raiders or more infected or whatever. You know, I think there's a lot of that conversation that is more for just specifically for Tommy and specifically trying to prevent more damage. Like, I think you can kind of tell she read the situation in the town meeting very similarly to what you were reading, where, like, I feel like she can read Ellie the same way. She knows that even though Ellie puts on a good speech and she says that she's going to adhere to whatever the town council goes with, there's no way she's not going to try and do something to go after the person that killed Joel. So I think, you know, Gail might be doing a little bit of damage control. She's wily, that Gail.
She is. No, I agree with that, your interpretation of that scene, and never underestimate a great actor with the television tool of this person gets a little tipsy and spits some truth, because what a powerful tool to be just like the drunk Jiminy Cricket of an entire town. You gotta love it. So back to that town meeting. We have Seth speaking up as sort of like giving the pro-violence speech, I think, that Ellie would ultimately like to be giving. But instead, we put it in the mouth of Seth. I want to talk a little bit about this, because I do think my understanding is this is a different fate than Seth has in the game when Seth pops up.
Yeah, I mean, in the game, we've already seen pretty much all of Seth's, because it's like they go and get the sandwiches from Seth in the game. And I think that's it. Like, that's the last time you see Seth. He gives Ellie and Dina at that point the sandwiches. And that's kind of it. He just apologizes. So this is a fun extension, I think, for Seth, and like to give him an actual arc beyond just being the bigot who Maria forced to apologize the next day, because it's, you know, it's Ellie being surprised, I guess, that this person that she would consider to be the opposite of her adversary in town, right, someone that she doesn't see much common ground with at all, finding common ground in, wanting to get vengeance on behalf of Joel, someone that you would think Seth would have no reason to want to get revenge for, because Joel's the one who humiliated him, right?
Yeah. No, I really like this mostly because I enjoy Robert John Burke as an actor. So him having more to do than just that side part, I really appreciated. And I thought it was nice and complicating. And a lot of the reactions I saw were like that. But I did read a piece on Polygon called The Last of Us. The Last of Us is The Last of Us apostrophe, which is where I'm going to say us is. I'm sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. The Last of Us post-apocalyptic homophobia reveals its shallow setting, where they make a very good argument that, yes, culture stopped in 2003 in the world of The Last of Us. And yes, if you were, in high school or college, like Neil and I were in 2003, we could tell you the world was very different in terms of watch an episode of Friends or something, in terms of casual homophobia being accepted. But that it is sort of weird in this fictional world that a lot of racism and sexism seems to have been conquered somehow, with people like Maria sort of running the council as a black woman. And so it sort of is lazy shorthand storytelling to have the D slur show up in Seth's mouth here. However, at the end of the, I do think that was an interesting point to make, and is probably a point about how television's written in general and how we sort of telegraph, like, complicated person for having wrong thought but does right thing. However, at the end she says, or they say, I don't think that Ellie should necessarily have to shake hands with a bigot in order to, like, exit. That's where I start disagreeing, because Ellie sort of, like, just agrees to be cordial, I think, at the shaking hand moment. And I think the whole show is about everybody sort of, like, existing in the gray. I do agree that it's weird that, you know, homophobia is the one that popped up, but I do think that it would pop up and then that person would have complicated three-dimensional opinions. So I am really enjoying the Seth redemption arc. I do see why, though, they kind of needed to hobble him with friendly fire. Otherwise, I'd be like, when is Seth coming back? But I'm pretty sure this is the end of the Seth arc.
Yeah, this is probably the last we see of Seth. I mean, and I agree. I mean, I think it doesn't seem like it's, like, rampant either. It's like this one guy who just can't let his homophobia go. Yeah. So it's, it doesn't seem like it's a huge cultural problem in the Jackson community. I also think that it's interesting too, that by keeping in the scene where he offers the sandwiches and having Ellie have the same reaction she has in the game, where she just doesn't say anything. She doesn't accept the sandwiches. She just kind of walks away. We have this sort of mini arc where she is not forgiving of Seth. She is very dismissive of Seth. She doesn't accept his apology. She still really has not accepted an apology from him for what he said at the New Year's dance. But she ends up in this place right before they leave, where she sort of begrudgingly accepts that they are on the same side, where he has helped her in at her lowest moment, right? With this thing that is beyond that supersedes all of that other stuff, right? Like, Joel was her dad, right? And mm-hmm. She literally watched him get stabbed in the head with a broken golf club, and she is going to go get revenge. Like, this is the biggest thing, most important thing that has ever happened in her life. And he, along with Dina, is the only person willing to help. So I think that, like, her shaking his hand is like an admission that, like, they're never going to be friends, right? If and when Ellie and Dina ever make it back to Jackson, they're not going to, like, have a drink with Seth. But I think she begrudgingly admits that, like, despite the fact that Seth is a terrible dude and said a terrible thing to them, she appreciates the fact that he is on the right side of this and that he is helping them get where they need to go, because everyone else in town said no, right? Other than the lady at the stables who helped Seth get Shimmer out. But like everyone else in town, you know, is not on their side. And so I think,
Do we think the lady at the stables is also on the council? Because you have a question here. Who were the three yes votes?
Well, this is really interesting. I don't think she was on the council. I have a theory. I think Tommy was one of the yes votes, right? I don't think he was lying when he told Ellie that he was going to support her, right? And I also think that Tommy, obviously Joel is his brother, he would want, especially in an anonymous vote, he would want to be able to stand up for Joel.
Yeah.
I also think that Jesse would say yes, despite the fact that Jesse is Captain Wyoming and seems to be very much on the rise. And this episode goes out of its way to show us that Jesse is sort of, you know, in the last episode when they were at the 7-Eleven, Ellie makes a comment about how, you know, she's like, everybody knows you're going to be in charge of Jackson someday, right? That he's like the heir apparent to this whole community. So he's very invested in taking on leadership role. But I also think that Jesse cares about both Dina and Ellie. So I think he would probably be a yes. My question to you is, do you think Maria was the third vote? Like, do you think Ellie's speech, and just in reading Maria's face, like Ellie's speech seemed pretty tailored specifically toward Maria. Do you think she was the third vote, or was it somebody else on the council?
I will say, logic of television says I don't know another person on the council, so yes, of course it was Maria. But also I believe Rutina Wesley said something very interesting in the like making of a section right after the episode, which is that she thought that Maria would be a no until Craig Mazin sort of like corrected her.
Okay.
And is like, no, of course Maria would be a yes on this. So I do think it's Tommy, Jesse, and Maria. However, if the stable woman was on the council, I'm willing to put her as one of the three, but the one I would take out is actually Jesse.
Okay. All right. I mean, there are plenty of good reasons why Jesse would vote no as well. Like, I feel like it's possible. I think, and this could be, you know, my thoughts from knowing more about Jesse's character and his relationship with these other characters from the game. Like, he has a very good friendship with both Dina and Ellie. So I want to believe that he would vote yes. But then again, Dina calling him Captain Wyoming.
Mm-hmm. And he did refuse to say that he was on Ellie's side during the punching bag sequence, which is both responsible and also maybe a sign that he would, you know, sort of be switched. Jesse just seems too responsible to me.
That's true.
So it seems like he might have liked Joel, but his youth might make him slightly more responsible.
He's a real Boy Scout, that Jesse.
I have some personal asides.
Okay.
That this episode made me remember. The coffee laying at the grave, Neil. I'm gonna be cremated, but if you wanna put some coffee wherever my ashes go.
Sure,
if you outlast me, that'd be great.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's a huge assumption that I'm gonna be around after you.
We'll
you're gonna go
goes.
First, but
I mean, in this fantastic world of American tariffs, I can't believe that this year me and my partner decided to see how many different types of coffee we could try. We're gonna bankrupt ourselves, but you know, coffee. I imagine hard to get. Sometimes now in the current world must be near impossible to get, especially in Wyoming in post-apocalypse. So I very much appreciated that as the kind of offering you would make at the grave. And it continues the grand tradition of coffee and television that I think, you know, definitely runs through the 90s with things like Twin Peaks or Friends coffee house aesthetic or anything like that, and up through Fringe's empty coffee cups. I think you just have some great coffee on television. Always great to see a series involving coffee. The second one has to get to when we're a little bit further on the road. We have the Ellie and Dina stumbling across the dead religious people, and Dina throws up, and me and my partner were like, oh, that's pregnancy. And so I went down a rabbit hole because I was like, is this the show telling us that that's a sign of pregnancy, or is this the fact that I've worked on pregnancy-related reality TV shows for 16 years now? And wouldn't you know it, well, 3/4 of all pregnancies apparently have an increase in stomach problems that include vomiting. They haven't actually scientifically linked the increased olfactory sensitivity and the nausea. Those are two definitely things that happen to pregnant women, but there hasn't been a study linked to it. The closest one I was able to find just said that there was compelling reasons, and it is on the NIH website. So who knows how long that's going to be up there. What a great time to be in America. All right.
Yeah,
I
have no comment other than it was definitely a lot of gross stuff. Then again, Dina, having lived in this world her entire life, has probably seen some gross stuff. So
yeah, let's talk more about Dina and Ellie's trip here, because I glossed over something just to make a personal point, which is the conversation that happens in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding was there was a grow house conversation we missed last week because Jesse took the place of Dina in the game at the grow house.
Sure.
Did we just get that in the tent?
No.
No. Okay.
Oh, no. Very different. Okay. And I think there is, they've obviously made some specific choices about the dynamic between these two characters. And I don't think that they're going to change maybe the entirety of it, like where it's going to end up. You know, I'm gonna be very tactful, hopefully, about this. You know, for folks who have played the game and sort of know how Dina and Ellie's relationship plays out, I think they're ultimately going to get to the same place, but I think they're kind of slow rolling it a little bit. It gets where it's going faster in the game than it does, than they're doing here. And I think that that is probably a function of them, A, breaking this game into two seasons, which is what we believe they're doing. They've already openly talked about not going past the game story in their three seasons that they have planned. So I think that they've got more time to spend with these two characters. You know, we've already talked about how this episode is already spending a lot more time that the game did not spend just in the aftermath of Joel's death, processing Joel's death. So I think we're going to have more time for these two characters to have this back and forth. But they've also kind of changed the dynamic of like who is kind of pursuing who in this situation, right? It seems like if I asked you, just based on what we've seen in the show, who is it that is sort of the pursuer in this relationship, and who is it that is being pursued, if we consider this to be a romantic courting?
I mean, it feels like Dina is pursuing Ellie, but I think that's just because Isabella Merced's just like bringing it so forward. Of a performance, whereas Ellie and Bella Ramsey's, they're playing it much more reserved, where like I see Bella getting nervous talking to Dina, but I don't see Dina getting nervous talking to Ellie.
Sure.
I think like that's a sort of confidence of the flirter that I've seen so far.
Yeah, like it seems like Ellie has sort of a more restrained crush at this point on Dina, but Dina's kind of toying with her.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that the TV show wants to maybe explore with a little bit more depth than maybe the game wanted to do. And I think we'll see how that works out. It's an interesting choice. We'll see how it works out for him. And I think that it's probably fine that we didn't get that. For anyone who's worried, it's a perfectly legitimate criticism for folks who are a big fan of that scene in the game to be like, I can't believe they left that out. Sure, fine. It's a great scene in the game. But, you know, also we did see Ellie stuff a giant pack of weed into her backpack. So in theory, we could see these two characters have a great smoke at some point later in the show. So like, we'll see how they weave that. And I think that the show's track record on making these adaptation adjustments has been pretty good so far. So I'm willing to give them a little room to play around. So I don't think we've really lost out on anything just yet. I will say it's, you know, I kind of agree with some of the criticisms that the flirtation is a little clunky, right? Like Dina's whole thing about, like, you know, you're gay and I'm not. It's like, but then to like come back at the end and be like, I wasn't even that high. It's, you know, I don't know.
I mean, maybe not. I can only speak as somebody who was like, again, in my final year of high school in 2003, it tracks of the 19-year-old girls I knew in 2003. Like, that's how they talked about bisexuality. Like, we didn't have Tumblr yet. We didn't like know how to talk about these things, at least around me. I'm not saying that I spent, you know, times in the inner sanctum of teenage girls. I mean, it does read clunky to me, but it reads clunky to me in a way like a 19-year-old, I'm sorry to call them girls, a 19-year-old woman would, you know, stumble through it. 19-year-old women who have killed multiple people. if they're trading stories of the first. I can't wait to hear Dina's story of her first kill. But like, you know, yeah, it didn't read that awkward to me. I mean, maybe the dialogue read a little awkward to me, but I think the chemistry was able to pull it through because I think these two actors know what they're doing with it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I enjoy the chemistry between these two, and I still think that they're selling that there is an awkward tension between the two of them, and that despite the fact that we now know that Dina, you know, went back to Jesse, whatever that means, that there's still something between Ellie and Dina, and, you know, now they're alone on the road together. So other than the two different militant groups that they're coming up against potentially, and the hordes of infected that we haven't seen yet in Seattle that I'm sure are there, you know, they've got plenty of time to figure that out, one assumes. So I think the show just is going to have potentially plenty of time to deal with that, I think.
Well, we finally get to Seattle, which to our two main travelers seems very calm, but then we cut to Manny in the Space Needle, what it looks like, but definitely very, very high up, keeping a watch out, and the Western Liberation Front moves forward, and they have a tank and what looks like a well-armed populace. Things are going to go down, even though we spent an entire episode with off-screen action and zero cordyceps zombies. Our girls are in trouble again.
For sure. Yeah, and I mean, we spent the rest of the episode with, you know, Ellie and Dina making a lot of assumptions about how simple this is going to be, right? Ellie's like, I'm going to go to Seattle, kill Abby. Easy peasy. And, you know,
Dina's like, there can't be that many of them.
Yeah, it's small enough for us to handle because no one's heard from them in a long time. And then the end of this episode gives us two scenes that show us, one, that they are extremely ruthless, right? They murdered all those people in the woods in a way that does not seem to have given those people with scars on their faces much chance of fighting back. And then we see that they are heavily armed and are not a small group whatsoever. If this is just one unit moving around, you can only imagine that they got more people. So, you know, it's again, for a bridge episode, right? This is an episode that gets us from the big moment of Joel's death to the rising action of, now we're in the shit in Seattle. it ends in a place that promises us that shit's about to jump off. And I like that. I think that's success in my mind, right? We did all of our character development. When we pick this story up, I imagine some things are going to happen.
Do you think production had crossover extras? Do you think if you play like a cordyceps zombie in episode 2, you could turn around and put on the wolf armor for episode 3?
Maybe. Or like if you're like a background person in Jackson, maybe now you're a wolf.
Yeah.
Or like maybe like maybe you're one of the scars.
Yeah, no, I think it needs to be like zombie to background or makeup to background, because sure. Otherwise we're going to start like, we can't have a Daenerys Starbucks cup situation where we suddenly notice that one of the Jackson people is part of the wolves, and all of us like Reddit's like, what does this mean for the plot of season 3? How did they beat Ellie there?
Then again, we are talking about HBO money, so I hope not. I hope they employed as many extras as possible.
Very true. All right. I think unless there's anything else you want to bring up, we are ready to transition into the storm. We ready to go, Neil?
Yep.
All right. So that's going to be it for you. If you do not want to speculate about the future of the series, knowing what we know about the video game, the next on preview, all that stuff, that's fine. We will see you next Wednesday to talk about the next episode of The Last of Us. For the rest of you, follow me into the storm.
I am the storm, brother. The first storm and the last.
Neil, we're in the storm.
Mm-hmm.
I had a whole thing about how sweet it was to put coffee on the grave, and then I did some Googling. And I'm like, oh, we haven't seen that scene yet, and the show hasn't done anything with coffee, to my knowledge. So I'm sorry I brought that up, but great job straight facing it.
Yeah, we'll come back to coffee. Don't you worry.
I've had personal feelings about coffee, and I'm like, now's the time.
Yeah, and I also would like to just appreciate the fact that we navigated the is Ellie lying thing pretty well, because she's lying about everything.
Everything.
Lying to Gale, lying to us.
All lies, all the way down.
But in fairness, as I was reminded by the game this past Monday when I was playing it, the game lies to you for a long time and a lot. So, you know, that's fun. Dave, shit's about to go down in Seattle.
Yeah. Yeah. I could sort of tell from the promo that we're at least getting to a showdown. It looks like between Dina and Ellie about her immunity.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's going to be a big thing. I wanted to start here in the storm though, with a raven. Of course you can email us your stormy thoughts to stormofspoilers@gmail.com. This one comes from Turtley, who says, I have a stormy question for Neil. Since the show doesn't have the luxury of forcing the audience to play as Abby, what story beats / relationships, etc. are important for the show to get right the rehab of Abby into someone we can root for, or at least not hate, because she is starting in a pretty deep hole. And it's funny because I read Phelan's email at the top of the column, and he ended his email with a PS about his partner Joanne hearing me last week say that Abby is not the villain of this story, and being like, she's like, that's bullshit, no way. And I promise you, at least in the video game, Abby is not the villain of this story. But it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of work for the game to get you all the way to the point where you no longer believe that Abby is the villain of the story. And I think that there are two things that the show is going to have to do that's going to have to land. One is it's going to take some time away from Abby. I think I saw this week that there was a discussion on a podcast, maybe I think with the it was on an awards podcast. It might have been with the casting director, where they talked about only having Caitlin Dever in this season for like 4 episodes total.
Oh, okay.
So we've had her for 2 so far.
We're halfway, yeah.
And we're only going to get her for 2 more, which means she may not come back till the end of the season. And I think that time away gives us, the audience, an opportunity to kind of forget a little bit about Abby, right? Like, Ellie's not going to forget about Abby, but she gets distracted by chasing after Abby's friends and getting sort of overwhelmed by the fact that there are way more wolves than she thought, and that she gets caught up in this conflict between the Scars and the Wolves, like caught in the middle of this thing. And so that becomes this distraction where you don't totally forget about Abby, but you kind of lose sight of the main purpose, I guess, for a while. And then when we pick back up with Abby, I think it's very important that the show land the Lev and Yara storyline. Lev and Yara are the Scar characters that Abby and
Seraphites. Neil, the Seraphites. They like to be called, yes. Seraphites.
We can call them that in the storm. I'm comfortable calling them Scars now in the calm because literally we've seen their scars.
Yeah, I'm just processing Seal trauma again. Seraphites.
But yeah, the Seraphite characters, I think, you know, once we get to, I don't know if they've even cast these characters yet. So I think this is a season three thing where they have to sort of land their storyline and the fact that Lev is sort of cast out of the Seraphites and Abby becomes sort of their only friend. And it causes Abby to be cast out of the Wolves. And she sort of goes on this hugely emotional journey. And by the time it brings her back around to Ellie, she has this completely new perspective. And we have this completely new perspective on her, which is something that in the game, hilariously enough, you don't learn until like way later after the fact, right? Like this week in my playthrough, I finally got through day three in Seattle. Because you play as Ellie through the first 3 days of Seattle, and you actually get all the way to where you find Abby again, and you meet Abby, and then it cuts away, right? And you're about, like, Abby and Ellie are about to have their big confrontation, and it cuts away, and now you're playing as Abby. And I was like, all right, we're going to stop here. And that's when you start to learn what Abby has been doing since she killed Joel, and you get, like, flashbacks to, you know, basically that's where you learn some of the information that we already know in the show, like that it was her dad that Joel killed, stuff like that. So I think the show is going to need to really land that stuff. Lev's going to be a very important character for them to stick the landing on. And I think that's not going to happen until season three, but you know, it's extremely possible that it can still work. I just think it's going to be really interesting if they do it at the same rhythm, right? Because that means that most of the rest of this season is Ellie's story, and then a huge majority of next season is Abby's story. And that TV wise seems psychotic to try and do that, but you know, it worked for the video game, so we'll see. And again, I reserve the right to reevaluate this position after we've seen a couple more episodes of season two, because you know, we'll see how much more Abby we actually get.
Well, it brings us back to the Lost days, where just like an antagonist is not necessarily a bad guy.
It's true.
So at some point we're going to be able to see, I think, or hopefully be able to see Abby as an antagonist, and then like switch at some point,
right,
to where the show is like, don't you want to see Ellie as an antagonist? And we're like, no, not really. And that's like the tension of the third season.
Yeah. Well, and I think, you know, one of the things that I picked up the last 2 weeks in my replay is that a lot of what happens in Seattle as you're playing as Ellie is about watching Ellie give in to her darkest impulses and watching Ellie sort of become this really dark version of herself. There is, and I think it'll be interesting to see how the show deals with this. Not only does she become an extremely violent version of herself, there's also this sort of physical transformation that I'm curious to see if they go for, where Ellie, she like, it almost seems like she loses a bunch of weight over the course of like 3 days, but she really just gets like really beat up because it's just such a violent couple of days where she is doing, she obviously encounters a lot of infected. She gets really horribly beaten up and knocked around, and she's just in a really bad place very quickly, emotionally and physically. And she does some stuff to Abby's friends that is just so violent that it really sort of shakes her, and to the point where it's like, you can tell that she's starting to question whether any of this is worth it, right? Like, she still wants to go get Abby, but it's like, by the time Jesse shows up and Jesse is like, we should just get Tommy and go back to Jackson, she still wants to go get Abby, but the look in, like, the light is going out in Ellie's eyes. And I think it is possible, very, you know, Empire Strikes Back, like, that we get to the end of season two and we as the audience may not feel great about Ellie, right? Like, she, I don't know if she'll be the antagonist of the series at that point, but we may feel like
beat someone to death at the end of the series. Yeah, like, right? This season,
we may feel pretty bad. Like, we may not get all the way to the point where she, like, stabs a pregnant lady in the neck or something, but, like, she may beat someone to death with her hands, to the extent where we're like, are we witnessing Ellie do things that are just as bad, if not slightly worse, than what we saw Abby do to Joel? And should we feel the same way about Ellie now? And I think that's the path that the game walks you down, is like, we, the player / audience, should feel bad about Ellie because Ellie doesn't feel good about what she's doing. And then it forces you to switch. And now you're playing as Abby, and it forces you to sort of take a different path and watch a bunch of terrible shit happen to Abby and feel bad for her. And you're like, well, damn, now I don't want bad things to happen to either one of these young women. Right.
Right.
And then it's like, then we're going to have a conflict between them. And by the time you get to the point where they're like, coming to blows, you're like, I don't want either one of these people to die, right? That's the magic trick of the game. And I think the show is going to have to do quite a lot of work to make that happen. But I think that first we've got to go down a dark road with Ellie. And I think that's going to potentially start next week. Although based on the teaser, Dave, I think next week is mostly going to be a little bit of happy stuff for Ellie and Dina, and then some wolf and infected based chaos. I think some more survival stuff for Ellie and Dina.
So I looked at the next on, and I looked at the promo images that we now have for episode 4. So as I was, like, sort of mentioning at the top, it looks like we're going to get the secret coming out because there's going to be some sort of encounter.
Sure.
With the infected in, like, the subway.
Yes.
A subway.
Yeah. So this is a direct, probably going to be a direct adaptation from the game. They end up in the subway. They have an encounter with the wolves. They end up down in the subway. There's a bunch of infected down there, and the wolves are down there, which is one of my favorite parts of the game, because if you play it right and you just, like, You end up, like, they're, like, hiding in one spot, and, like, the wolves are there, and there's, like, clickers all around. And if you want to be really cheeky, you could just, like, throw a bottle or a brick, and then they fight each other. And the clickers can, like, take care of the wolves for you, and then you just have to, like, kill a couple clickers. Or it just turns into this, like, chaotic mess. Eventually, you know, Dina and Ellie have to run, and Ellie's mask gets knocked off. I believe next week we're also going to get introduced to spores.
Nice.
So they're going to have to put masks on, and Ellie's mask gets knocked off. Dina kind of freaks out. They eventually get out, and I have a feeling that's why Dina is pointing the gun at Ellie. It's like, she thinks she's just been infected, and she's like, I'm going to have to shoot you in the face. Right. They made a joke in the first episode of this season about, am I going to have to shoot you in the face if you get bit? So, yeah, that's the moment where Dina is going to find out that Ellie is immune. And that's, you know, moment of tension. But I think I love that as a teaser moment, because, you know, people who aren't familiar with what happens in the game are going to be like, oh, my God, are they going to be on the outs? But no, eventually she's going to accept the fact that Ellie is immune, and they'll be fine after that.
I mean, which is pretty great,
but I think it's going to be a very cool sequence, because it's a very thrilling action sequence in the game because it brings sort of everybody together. Although sadly, Dave, you know, we've been talking about Shimmer the last couple of weeks. And guess what happens right before they get to the subway?
Shimmer goes down.
So I notable lack of Shimmer proof of life in that teaser makes me believe that maybe Shimmer meets his end here pretty quickly.
Well, we have some guitar playing. Maybe before Shimmer meets his
probably end. Before Shimmer meets his end. Shimmer's definitely around for the guitar playing. There's a music store scene that I think what's funny. I know you haven't watched this week's episode of The Leftovers that we're covering, but in that episode, the song Take On Me is prominently featured. Mm-hmm. And in the video game, Ellie sings Take On Me to Dina in the music store. So it'll be, I have a feeling they're going to use the same song because we know HBO can get the rights to it. So it's going to be, because we haven't seen Bella Ramsey sing yet, right? We haven't seen Pedro sing yet either.
No.
Okay. So, I mean, I'm pretty sure we're going to see both of those things before the season is out. Obviously, Pedro in flashback form. But my guess is that they're going to go directly with having Take On Me because it's a great, great scene in the game. And nice. I think a really solid moment in their sort of relationship and a nice, like, quiet, serene, lovely moment before everything sort of jumps off in the subway.
Well, we also have in the promo images some Jeffrey Wright.
Yep.
But not only Jeffrey Wright in his sort of militia or his wolf leader look, but it looks like also in like a Fedra suit. Mm-hmm. So do you think we get some flashbacks to how he got where he is?
This is really interesting because he obviously plays Isaac, which is a character that he has played in the game. And it's a very early introduction for Isaac in general, right? We actually don't meet Isaac in the game until Abby's storyline. So like I've played all the way through Ellie's Seattle storyline, still haven't met Isaac. We've heard of Isaac, right? We've heard over the radio and in letters that we've picked up of like characters running from the wolves that like Isaac is telling them to move around the city and whatnot. We haven't actually met him yet. So, but I think it's good that the show is going to introduce him because he's a very important character. Obviously, he's the leader of the wolves. And I do think kind of like they did, you know, with Melanie Lynskey's character in Kansas City, he's going to have a slightly bigger presence in Seattle than maybe he did in the games. So it'll be nice to have a little bit more backstory for him because he has a big presence in the game, but he's not around for very long. He has important stuff to do in Abby's story, but it's not, I think, again, TV logic, production logic says we want to get our money's worth for Jeffrey Wright. Yeah. And my guess too is that they probably want to have him around not just for this season, right? Because I think we talked about this last week in the storm. There's a big action set piece where the wolves lay siege to this Seraphite's island that they're mm-hmm. trying to inhabit. That I think I have been thinking could be something at the end of this season, but the more and more I think about it, especially if they haven't cast Lev and Yara yet, I think could be an early season 3 thing. And that requires Isaac to be around for season 3 because he's there. So I think it would stand to reason that they would want to keep Jeffrey Wright's presence around for 2 seasons, especially if we're going to expend all of our Pedro Pascal in flashback form in this season. We obviously don't know if Pedro's going to come back for season 3 or if like they've shot everything they need from him already and that they're just going to use some additional footage in season 3. My guess is that he's probably not going to have to shoot anything for season 3, but we'll see.
Pedro Pascal, of actors I've had to cover in the past 20 years, is between this and The Mandalorian, the most I don't know what he's in until he shows up. I don't know how many episodes he's in. I don't know.
Yeah.
That while he was shooting this, they shot a whole Mandalorian movie with him in it. It's so true. Like, I don't.
He's simultaneously like the most booked and busy dude in all of Hollywood, right? Like he's in the Fantastic Four. He's probably signed on for at least like 10 more Marvel movies, but we
right
don't know
now,
anything
I
about
guess
that.
He's shooting Doomsday. Like, yeah, like I guess
I assume Reed Richards is in all of those other Marvel team up movies, but who knows? So it's like we don't know how much more juice they're going to be able to squeeze from the Pedro Pascal of it all. It does feel like they're priming the audience, and this could be a sleight of hand move, right? Taking him out of the credits, right? His name's not in the credits this week.
Mm-hmm. They took his silhouette out of the credits.
This I think is potentially a clever move for non-video game knowers to be like, he's totally gone, and then like two episodes from now, hit you with a hugely emotional flashback, and it's going to be great. People are going to love it. But I don't know how much you can do that all the way into season three, especially as the story progresses, and it really does come down to like, this is coming to a head between Ellie and Abby. You can't rely on those flashbacks. So I think, having Jeffrey Wright around and putting more into Isaac's story could be very useful for the show from like a star power standpoint.
I mean, I definitely agree, but I also think there's no way you do the finale to this series and don't have Pedro Pascal in it.
I mean, he's in the final scene for sure.
Okay.
But they've already shot footage that could be used for that.
Fair. Yeah, they know exactly where they're going with it.
Like that, I think, if I remember correctly, is stuff that they probably already shot. So, I think that they've potentially, if they've shot all the flashbacks that I've seen in the game up to the point that I've played in my replay, I think that's all the footage they need for the rest of the show. So they could be done with him. I think you want to get your money's worth with Isaac. Yeah.
But I still think we're gonna have a full flashback episode this season.
Full episode.
There's just, we keep Eugene-ing it up, and like,
I don't know.
I think Eugene's the whole thing.
I think, okay, so there are, in my mind, if I am counting correctly, now that I've played through Ellie's storyline in the game, I'm gonna walk you through the flashbacks. There's a longer flashback with Ellie and Joel at a museum, which is mm-hmm. definitely happening because there's an Easter egg for it in this episode. There's a fedora in Ellie's room that it plays a huge part in that flashback.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the astronaut playing the guitar, which
the astronaut is also relevant. We've also seen the dinosaur in the season trailer. That's part of it. There is another flashback with Joel and Ellie in Jackson where they're going to get guitar strings that I think they'll probably do because it is very relevant to, their relationship and also has a pretty great bloater moment. So that's two. There's a third one. There's another Joel and Ellie flashback that I had forgotten about, but it plays very late in Ellie's Seattle story, but is hugely pivotal. And it sort of exposes yet another thing that Ellie knows that she's not telling us, the audience, just yet. So that's three. And then the fourth one would be something about Eugene. I think that's too much for one episode. I think that that is the sort of thing that you would spread those across multiple episodes instead of packing them into one episode.
I mean, I'm fine, yes, but I do think Eugene is a possibility for them to just tell a completely different story for an episode.
Maybe.
To sort of like knit together some of these things. I think that is also the episode where if it isn't 100% flashback, they make up something for Tommy to do back in Jackson Because in my mind, Tommy going to Seattle has to be like a beginning of the season three thing. And I'm not sure what motivates him there.
Sure.
But that's the thing that makes me feel.
It's another really interesting question, which is how does Tommy end up in Seattle? I could see him going after Ellie against Maria's wishes.
Right. But how long is it? Because we're only talking about 3 days. So how long does he wait before he goes after him? Because like if he waits 3 days, then he doesn't show up until season three in the timeline.
Sure. Sure. Same thing with Jesse. Jesse eventually has to go after them as well. Or maybe Tommy and Jesse go together in the show. That'll be sort of interesting. Because again, now that I've played through Ellie's storyline, they both really need to be there for the big confrontation.
Yeah. Well, unless they're going to make to be there
significant changes.
They're both the heir apparents, then I think you need an episode about why they get to leave. Like, I think, talk about star power. If they leave and we're done with Jackson, I got some characters I still like back there.
Yeah, that's true. And it is interesting, though, because, again, I read this episode, The Path, as the Bill and Frank diversion episode.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know where a full flashback episode fits in the rest of the story. I did see a tweet today, and I don't know how reliable this is. Hold on. I think I bookmarked it, where they said that they released the next two episode titles. This has burned us before.
It has burned us before. So what if we do next week's episode and we end with Dina drawing down on Ellie, and then we do the flashback episode about when that happened to Eugene?
I mean, maybe.
So like an episode five flashback episode. I do agree with you that there's times to like cut back. Like, I wouldn't be against, like, if we're doing, you know, a guitar store, like the promotional images are saying, doing a guitar strings flashback episode. Moment or something like that, just to show that Joel isn't here. I do wonder how long they're gonna hold that back, because you are also right that it's tipping hands to people who don't know anything about the game that maybe Pedro Pascal's off the show, but just to have him pop up again next week might not give him enough time to leave the show.
Yeah. Okay, I found a tweet. It was from today.
Yeah.
And it's from a Last of Us news account. I don't know if this is real, but it says that episode 4 is reportedly titled Day 1, which would match with sort of how the game plays out, the Seattle storyline. It's been Day 1, 2, and 3.
Okay.
And then episode 5 is called Feel Her Love, which is a direct reference to the prophet, the Seraphite prophet. So that, to me, would suggest that there is just a lot more forward Seattle-focused momentum.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, then my theory would be that the flashbacks are sprinkled in and not, or that it's like an episode 6 or 7 thing, if it's going to be a full episode.
I mean, it would be crazy to, at the end of episode 6, just be like, and now for something completely different, and have episode 7 be a 100% flashback episode. But maybe that's what I want. I don't know. This series seems to be doing a pretty good job, but I guess I would say, in terms of thrill and HBO genre show, I agree with you that this is sort of the hitting the brakes, the take a timeout, tell a character specific thing, let us do that. But is that going to be the only time we do that this season? Or do we have to keep up the violence? We'll have to see. Sure. Going forward.
Yeah, I mean,
the show has me on the back foot slightly.
Quite a lot more violence to come, right? Like, this next episode, I have a feeling is going to have a lot of action in it, with the subway sequence and the first few encounters with the wolves. And then from there, it's a lot of, Ellie and Dina go to the TV station and have a very violent encounter with the wolves. Then Ellie goes to the hospital and has a very violent encounter with the wolves. And, it's sort of nonstop from there. Then Ellie's in a boat having a violent encounter with the Seraphites. So we'll see. I do think it's interesting that they chose to have our first encounter with the Seraphites be the wolves killing them, because in the game, it's obviously it's different perspective in the game, but you're playing as Ellie and you hear a whistle. It's great. You're like cutting through the park on your way. I think you're on your way to the hospital to find Nora, like the second of Abby's friends that you're going after. And you hear one of those loud, long whistles, and then you just get whacked with an arrow. And all of a sudden you're like in the middle of this fight and you have to like kill all these Seraphites without asking any questions. And I'm sitting there like, couldn't we have talked this out? But no, you have to like murder them all. So it's funny because like you end up with the same result, a bunch of dead scars, but it's you as Ellie who has to kill them all. So I think it's fascinating that the show chose to make her just, you know, the person that finds them later.
Yeah, it looks like next week Ellie and Dieter are going to stumble across somewhere that has Feel or Love painted on it. But it also looks like it has a whole bunch of equipment. So maybe the wolves have just cleaned it out.
Sure. My guess would be a TV station.
All right.
They come upon the TV station first, and it's sort of after there has been a skirmish between the Seraphites and the wolves. And what's interesting about that is that it's the first time we see the capability of the Seraphites as a military force. Cool. Because what we don't know yet, or at least what the television audience doesn't know, we see them in this first episode as, you know, maybe a peaceful religious group, right? Just trying to survive, trying to get away from the war.
Mm-hmm.
They are not to be fucked with. Like they are not peaceful doves, right? They are dangerous. They are silent killers. Yeah, they're like hanging wolves really brutally. They are very dangerous, the bow and arrow. Like they are really gnarly fighters. And Ellie and Dina learn very quickly that, yes, there are a lot of wolves. They're very bad. They're very dangerous. But the scars are just as bad and just as to be avoided. So, you know, Seattle is a very shitty place to be in this world.
Gotta explore some more love violence. Yep. Over on The Last of Us on HBO.
Everybody's murdering in Seattle for love.
Yeah, gotta love it. And we do, and I can't wait for next Sunday to see some more Cordyceps action, and it'll be another great day to feel bad for the people of The Last of Us. So yeah, I think that's gonna be it for this week. Join us next week as we break down yet another episode of The Last of Us. And until then, be excellent to each other.